I'll start with a quote from Warren Buffett, the second richest man in the world. And he writes, "I don't have a problem with guilt about money. The way I see it is that my money represents an enormous number of claim checks on society. It's like I've got these little pieces of paper that I can turn into consumption. If I wanted to, I could hire 10,000 people to do nothing but paint my picture every day for the rest of my life." And, yeah, this is in his words. And he owns an estimated $52 billion. And if you compare this to the 754,147 registered homeless people in the United States, and of these homeless people, only 2% are above the age of 61, simply because life on the streets is so harrowing that most of them don't get to see that age. And of course, there's inequality here too. In 2004, a Senate committee inquiry found that up to 4.4 million Australians live below the poverty line, many making up a layer of the working poor. Of course, on the other end of the spectrum, CEOs earn 98 times the wage of an ordinary worker. The Woolworths CEO, Roger Corbett, earned $8.4 million last year, which is over $160,000 per week. And in other words, an ordinary full-time supermarket worker would have to work for over 5 years to get what this fucker does in 1 week. So really, it's pretty clear. The world is divided into class. You know, the days in which it was possible for the system to claim that it was making people's lives better, these days are well and truly gone. The point of this talk, and really the whole conference, however, is to understand how we can overthrow these glaring inequalities. Class is not just something that exists just to be defined, but it's a key to actually changing the world. I'll be arguing that the working class has the power to radically shake the foundations of today's inhumane society and construct a new world. And to prove this, it's really important to know what we're talking about. So I'll start by presenting definitions of class, and hopefully this will flow more or less naturally into the way class can bring about radical change. So really, to begin with, we need to be much more specific than just looking at money or standard of living to define class. To limit the analysis to these factors would be quite misleading, because dock workers, for instance, in this country, are some of the best paid workers around, earning up to $80,000 a year. Despite this, they are also some of the most militant unionists. And the same is true of those in the construction industry, the mining industry, and so forth. Similarly, there are a lot of analyses that only look at class in terms of the gap between the first and the third world. This approach is also incorrect, as it lumps all of the inhabitants of the third world into the same category, which implies that people in the first world should cut their consumption to address inequality. But this really does miss the relationships of exploitation which clearly exist within the first world as well. Occupation is another one that's seen as the key dividing line. Manual workers are the proletariat, and service workers are something completely different, something post-industrial. But really, like, is a service worker at McDonald's who hands over your Big Mac that different from a worker that works in a cannery or a Coles packing plant? You know, in terms of pay and conditions, they're probably worse off. So, you know, this definition, again, is insufficient. Finally, there's, you know, I think one of the most nutty ones. A lot of sociologists define class in terms of the ideas that people have in their heads. Really, with this kind of methodology, though, you know, it's hard to see why poor people don't just change their way of thinking until they're rich. And go figure. And, I mean, but, you know, on a more even keel, well, you know, 10 years ago, not many people thought of themselves as working class, whereas now, the Labour Party's rhetoric of working families really does have resonance. So using this kind of methodology of looking at people's ideas just doesn't provide a stable way to see things. The point is that really we've got to look at something that exists. And wealth, lifestyle, culture and ideas, these are surface phenomena. They do correlate strongly to certain classes, and that's the case. But it's really necessary to analyse classes in regards to their relationship to the economy and production. So the American Marxist Hal Draper wrote, "The proletariat consists of those whose livelihood depends on a wage relationship with employers of labour power. So as workers, we must sell our ability to labour to an employer. This employer can be the state or a private boss, and an individual worker can produce a tangible commodity or they can produce a service. So long as someone is selling their labour power to an employer and they aren't the employers of labour themselves, this makes them working class. And indeed, as workers, we are commodified. We're forced to sell our labour power on a daily basis at market rates, just like any other commodity. This means that for the system to operate, workers cannot own enough property to sustain themselves independently of needing to sell their ability to labour. Many own a house, a mortgage, a car, what have you, but not enough to live on independently. We can choose an employer, but really that's about all the choice we have in life. And so by way of contrast, the other major class in society, the capitalist class, or the bourgeoisie, they own the vast majority of the world's wealth, and these people are the main employers of labour. The type of property which is central to the bourgeoisie is capital, hence the term capitalists. Capital refers to property which enables the production of more wealth. So although wealth is created exclusively by labour, this does actually require tools. So in modern society, these tools are the factories, the infrastructure, the means of communication, and so on. Marx termed these things the means of production, and it's monopoly ownership of these things which gives the bourgeoisie the ability to force people to work for a wage. As a further result of this ownership, the bourgeoisie becomes entitled to the products of labour and therefore the profit that can be made from their sale. Owning capital and employing workers is what gives the bourgeoisie its social control and obscene wealth. For many capitalists, ownership of the means of production is indirect. You know, big capitalists have interest in dozens of companies, and most of them haven't even seen the things that they own. So, by way of a case study, let's look at BHP Billiton. BHP Billiton employs 38,000 people worldwide, and this makes it the biggest mining operator in the world. BHP's capitalisation, that is to say the value of the means of production that it encompasses, is $93 billion. And its revenue, that is the total income for last year, was $32 billion. Of this, $18 billion were taken up by running expenses. This includes maintenance, upkeep of facilities, logistics, equipment and wages. The remaining $14 billion, before tax deductions, were pure profit, making BHP very lucrative indeed, with a profit rate of about 15%. This profit was not redistributed to the people who created it by working 12-hour shifts, dragging up metals from the ground. If it had been redistributed to these people, this would have meant a $36,000 bonus for every BHP Billiton worker in the year. This clearly didn't happen. Instead, this profit is the legal property of the shareholders of BHP, and they, of course, elect the board of directors to administer the money, some of which is paid back to shareholders in the form of dividends, other parts of which are reinvested. So since 2001, roughly $10 billion has been given back to the shareholders of BHP, most of whom have never seen a mine in their lives. And really, what right should people have to earn money without having worked for it? You know, this is the common sense logic that capitalism destroys every day. So in 1998, 78% of all shares and similar investments were held by only 5% of the population. And since then, inequality has increased dramatically. Over the last 15 years, CEO pay rates have gone up by 564%. The working mum and dad shareholders, these are really mythological beasts. They don't exist. So to summarise, rich shareholders and property owners receive the profits generated by the labour power of others, simply as a result of their ownership of corporations. Marx referred to this profit as the surplus value, and it's created by labour. The working class is paid for its labour, but never to the value of what they produce. This is the bare economic fact on which capitalism relies. This is what Marxism terms exploitation. In this sense, transport workers, professionals, service workers and so on, in that they all produce for the system, are all workers. As I said earlier, anyone that works for a wage and who doesn't own capital is a member of the proletariat, a member of the working classes. Using this methodology, socialist academics Rick Kuhn and Diane Field, both of whom you can meet at this conference, estimated that the Australian working class and their families and their direct dependents number about 13 million people, so a majority of the Australian population. Take into account service workers, industrial workers, agricultural wage workers, the total number of wage workers globally stands at an estimated 1 billion people. With the addition of their dependents, this figure is easily in the vicinity of 2.5 billion people worldwide. And it goes without saying, you know, this makes the proletariat much bigger than it was in Marx's day. Finally, of course, it does bear mentioning that there are other classes in society. The middle classes, for instance, occupy sort of a grey area between the working class and the ruling class. They're the small property owners who are also forced to work themselves, often quite long hours, and they also have no real control over the system. Similarly, there are other peripheral classes, such as students, who are workers in training and who often work part-time jobs themselves. What I'm arguing, though, is despite the existence of these other classes and layers in society, the central divide in modern society is between the bourgeoisie and the proletariat, the working class and the ruling class. But so far this talk has been largely descriptive, whereas the title clearly alludes to changing the world, class being the key to radical change. This is not coincidental. It's not just that there happen to be classes and they happen to be changing things. Rather, the objective situation of workers gives them a unique social power. They don't just sit there, these social classes, but they continually interact and often come into really sharp conflict. The bourgeoisie cannot survive without the working class. A world of owners with no producers is pretty unimaginable. Despite this, the bourgeoisie wishes that it didn't have to deal with the working class. Now, relying on this massive, powerful, exploited layer is pretty unstable. So the ruling class uses every means at its disposal to stifle and prevent working class rebellion. They use the media and the education system to convey ideology that supports the system. So, for instance, law courses teach that theft should be punished, while the property of multimillionaires should be protected. Commerce courses teach students how bosses can best screw over their workers by putting them all on AWAs, Australian Workplace Agreements. Philosophy courses teach that the working class doesn't exist and that really everything's just a discourse and there's no point to it all. So, worse still is the mass media, Hollywood. There's a recent movie out, 300, I don't know if you guys have heard about it, but basically a group of freedom-loving Spartans hold off a massive horde of Middle Eastern Persians. And really, I'll let you guys read into the values that that contains. So, on top of this, the political system is designed to dull criticism and funnel it into the appropriate channels. Young activists who want to change the world are told that they should try and reform the system from within. But really, the example of Peter Garrett is conclusive about this one. You can't change the system, but the system can change you. Should these means fail, the rulers can use the police to protect the sacred right to property. Let's not forget that striking is illegal in this country. Any attempt to seriously challenge corporate power will come up against the state at one point or another. Ultimately, however, the weakness of the ruling class is that they cannot provide a good life for the mass majority of humanity, and nor can they avoid crisis. The system is fiercely competitive, both between corporations and businesses and between nations. This means that no matter what an individual capitalist thinks or feels, he or she is ruthlessly driven to increase exploitation. This means driving down wages and living standards. Advances in technology which make production more efficient also throw people out of work. This is why there is an outcast layer in society of unemployed people who are marginalised by the system. The working class has a very concrete interest in lessening this exploitation. They do this by trying to increase wages, ridding better conditions and so forth. Trade unions, by their very existence, acknowledge this fundamental reality. Trade unions, no matter how conservative, are a reflection of the collective interests of the working class. Now, every strike sort of says that we will exert our collective strength and cease production until our rights are acknowledged. But because production cannot continue without labour, strikes are one of the most effective weapons that we have against capitalism. So both large struggles and small ones bring workers into conflict with the ruling class ideology and state. The introduction of the IR laws and the massive community protests against them were massively educational for the people of Australia. They really put on display the collective power of the working class. And ultimately, as workers, we have an interest in a society free from classes. From the point of view of the producing classes, the class of capitalists is parasitic and utterly destructive. If we continue to demand a better life, free from war and racism, and with decent medical care, housing, education and so forth, eventually these demands become revolutionary demands, simply because the system cannot meet these needs. These concrete class interests are what inform political positions and parties. The Liberal Party, for instance, doesn't just simply act on its own behest. Its policies are carefully crafted and tested to match the interests of the Australian ruling class. The IR laws, for instance, they're not about ideology. They're not about some ancient grudge Howard's had against the unions. Really, they're about big business. And the results of the laws, which have recently been compiled in a survey of AWAs signed since the laws have been introduced, prove it. 100% of new AWAs, that's Australian Workplace Agreements, the individual contracts that are now law, 100% of these reduce conditions. About 60% are at a lower rate of pay. And anyway, these contradictory interests give rise to struggle. Class struggle is a permanent feature of society. You know, you've got really small instances like sneaking an extra 5 minutes break or stealing from work to big examples like strikes, demonstrations and ultimately revolutionary movements. Class struggle is a perennial feature of society. And part of the nature of class struggle is that it tends to expand outwards, including more and more workers. This is because the working class is a collective class. For example, in 1996, a strike by 12 people in a General Motors factory in Ohio, in the United States, shut down all General Motors production in Canada and Mexico for 17 days. That's 12 people on strike. Work stoppages by dock workers or by commercial pilots can affect every part of the world. Additionally, workplaces are concentrated. Building sites, warehouses, supermarkets, hospitals, factories, power stations, all of these things combine large numbers of workers in the one location, and this naturally leads towards trade unionism and a collective spirit. This collective spirit can develop into cross-union solidarity, opposition to racism, sexism, and so forth. But most importantly for this talk is to prove that the working class is capable of truly radical, revolutionary change. So I've already talked about the things that push workers into struggle. What is it then that makes them capable of creating a totally new democratic world? And I don't just want to pose this in the abstract. You know, I'm going to use an example from Australia to flesh out my point. And I'm going to use the example from 1998, the Maritime Union of Australia, the MUA, and their struggle against John Howard's union busting. Now, this wasn't a revolutionary struggle, but it was successful. I would argue that it contained within it the seeds of workers' power. The militancy and solidarity on display in 1998 are proof that the working class can take initiative. So in 1998, the Howard government took aim at the militant MUA in order to break it. They wanted to undermine the union with scab labour, and by doing so, they wanted to pave the way for future attacks on the union movement. And as I said earlier, class struggle does bring us into conflict with the system and the things that reinforce the system. This was the case with the MUA dispute. Prior to the attacks, workers in many industries gave their promises of instant strike action should the MUA workers be sacked. Australian workers paid out of their own pockets $1.2 million to support the MUA. When the sackings came, thousands of workers stopped work immediately and marched to the docklands to form picket lines. Thousands of workers turned up at the East Swanston Dock here in Melbourne, and really things looked close when 1,000 cops turned up to smash the picket line. Despite this, thousands of students, pensioners, workers linked arms and held on until 3 o'clock that night, at which point 2,000 more cops came to attack the picket line. In which thousands more cops came to attack the line. 2,000 construction workers then turned up and surrounded the cops who had to beg to be let out. So there you go. It's a workers' vital role in production, however, that gives them the power and the potential to take over production. Capitalism actually trains people to run the world themselves. The people who manage the intricate logistical networks of modern capitalism, who oversee the communication systems that exist between the millions of people, these are all paid workers. John Howard and the bosses, they were, and they still are, scared of the MUA because it is a union of just such workers, totally central to the system and well-organised and political. Today's businesses, they're managed for profit at the expense of humanity. Workers' management of business, on the other hand, would be dramatically different. You know, focused on need. Immediately, the massive wastage that occurs every day under capitalism, through military expenditure, through advertising, unnecessary competition, this could be redirected. Every strike requires organisation and continual political discussion. Continuing a strike requires the organisation of strike pay. Defending a strike against attacks by the boss and attempts by the boss to bring in non-union scab labour, this requires militancy and organisation. Against an attempt to lock workers out in order to break them, this means a strike committee can decide to occupy a workplace. And in this way, democratic institutions, strike committees, which are formed in the struggle, can become a new way of collectively managing and administering a workplace free from bosses and owners. This type of rank-and-file organisation was present in the MUA's struggle. The organisation at East Swanston quickly sprung into place to coordinate the work of thousands of MUA supporters. Each union was rostered to provide picketers for particular time slots. A telephone tree of thousands was established to alert supporters of any moves that the police made. At any one time, several hundred workers and supporters would be at the Melbourne picket line contributing whatever skills they had. You know, the festive atmosphere, the solidarity and the sense of purpose of people that were there really struck everyone that turned up to this protest. And most importantly, these inspiring events were not organised from the top down, but by the community itself. community assemblies took matters into their own hands. These organisations, spontaneously generated and completely democratic, show the capacity for self-organisation that resides within the working class. In the situation of a general strike, committees are elected to oversee such day-to-day issues of the struggle. As struggle continues, day-to-day issues become vital and very political. Food distribution, transportation, the maintenance of life. General strike committees can and have started to take an administrative role over aspects of society. And this fundamentally includes political debate. A general strike, or even just a partial strike, in a key industry, can become a life and death issue for the ruling classes. For our side, debate really does become a matter of victory or defeat. And as a result, deep political debate is necessary. To continue to victory or to compromise, you know, to trust Labor or to take matters into your own hands. Simply, we must show solidarity towards oppressed minorities in order to overcome racism and sexism, in order to broaden the movement out and guarantee success. During the MUA struggle, debates regarding sexism were absolutely crucial to ensure the support of women on the picket lines. Similarly, international workers showed solidarity with their Australian comrades. In San Francisco, dock workers refused to unload ships loaded in Australia by scabs. In Spain, workers in a Holden factory took stop work action to support the strikers in Australia. And the MUA dispute was victorious. The union survived, and most people kept their jobs. It also set Howard's union-busting plans back by years. Despite this, a compromise was reached by conservative union leaders, which saw roughly 700 jobs lost and conditions cut. Socialist workers in this situation have a responsibility to be organised and to argue for the next step towards victory and against compromise. In a revolutionary situation, socialist positions become absolutely vital to success. Having a correct attitude towards the state, believing that the working class should take state power, have been central questions in previous revolutions. And in this way, some of the issues that we've been talking about this weekend are actually posed by movements themselves and are do or die questions. In this revolutionary movement, working class people finally become fully aware of themselves as part of a class. The expansion of strike committees to whole cities and nations, workers can experience their collective decision-making power. This type of experience, which knocks apoliticism and right-wing ideas out of people, makes them capable of building a socialist world. People who have been told all their lives that their opinions are worthless are finally given the ability to express themselves and exert control over their own lives. And historically, workers' councils have been a vigorous and totally democratic weapon with which workers can defend themselves against the reimposition of capitalism. Workers in these strike committees have the right of recall should the delegates misrepresent them. Delegates are non-privileged, workers themselves, and administrative positions are held entirely by elected workers. This, of course, means that the unelected bureaucracy, which is characteristic of today's state, is abolished. This means that the autocratic control of the police and army is abolished. This means, ultimately, that the present state can no longer be used by a minority to exploit a majority. These are some of the things that ensure that such a revolutionary system would not be able to be undermined by selfish individuals or a new ruling class. A revolutionary workers' democracy is characterised by total transparency and continual debate. And really, as I've mentioned, the inspiration for these struggles and these structures has not just been cooked up by Marxists sitting in a library. Other sessions at this conference detail revolutions which have actually seen workers' power come to the fore organically. And we can learn from the MUA struggle the capacity that workers have to profoundly change the world. We can learn that class struggle is a permanent feature of society, and that this struggle will intensify, sometimes faster, sometimes slower, until a revolution bursts forth into the world. Now, the oppressed will take a stand, decrying the heart-wrenching inequality that exists and that's so rife today, and will set about constructing a new world. And really, this is the time that we've got to be prepared for. Thanks.